We're back in Revelation. We're back in chapter 17, looking at the picture of the beast and the harlot and the heads and the horns. You know, this week I was talking with one of my friends about abstract art. I don't talk about art often, and in fact, I never bring up the subject because my tastes in art are very pedestrian. I have very, very boring tastes in art. You know, for me, if somebody says, here's a drawing of an apple or a painting of an apple, I want it to look like an apple. I want it to look like an apple that I would pick off a tree or an apple that I would see at Tom Thumb or Walmart. You know, I don't want it to look like just shapes and sizes. And I don't want it to represent anything. To me, an apple should just be an apple. It shouldn't be temptation. It shouldn't be bounty. It should just be an apple. Like I say, you know, I've never been an art critic. Well, I guess I am, though, because that's pretty critical, isn't it? No, let me say this. I'm critical of art, but I'm not an art critic. How's that? But I remember one time back when I was in high school, we went to the Art Institute in Chicago, which is a long trip from here, but it was only 20 minutes from where I used to live. And we were going through the Art Institute, which is really a magnificent building, and we stumbled, my friends and I stumbled into an abstract art display. And they had a whole room set up with abstract art. And, you know, it was colors and it was shapes. And you'd go and you'd read the caption. And I think one was like, girl on a bicycle. And I looked at it and I thought, yeah, girl on a bicycle if you put them through a wood chipper. I mean, really? Girl on a bicycle? But in that room, they also had a young woman who was going from picture to picture and was giving a mini lecture on all the pictures. And I don't honestly remember, you know, if it was Klein or Gottlieb or whoever the artist was. But she would go to these pictures, and she would stand beside a picture, and she'd say, you know, here's what the artist uses as far as technique goes. This is what the artist was striving for. This is how he uses light. These are some of the things you look for. And you know something? As I listened to her, by the time she was done, you could actually begin to conceptualize what that picture was supposed to be and appreciate it a little bit more. I still didn't like abstract art, but at least I it was a little less confusing. Well, when chapter 17 opens in the book of Revelation, John is presented with a rather abstract picture. John is presented with an abstract of a scarlet beast with 7 heads, 10 horns, being ridden by a tarted up harlot in the middle of a wilderness. And underneath it, I guess it said girl on a bicycle. You know? But John knew that wasn't girl on a bicycle. It wasn't an apple. What is it? So 2/3 of chapter 17 are really devoted to God's explanation of what that image means, of making the abstract a little bit more concrete, not simply for John's edification, certainly, but for ours as well. So last time, 2 weeks ago when we looked, we began the explanation and we looked at the beast itself and the 7 heads of the beast. This week, we look at the rest of the explanation as we wrap up chapter 17, and we get more of a concrete idea of what that abstract image is. So this week, we look at Revelation 17, picking up at verses 12 through 18, keeping in mind that this is strictly an explanation of that abstract image. The 10 horns, this is the angel, the bull angel speaking, the 10 horns which you saw are 10 kings who have not yet received a kingdom, but they receive authority as kings with the beast for 1 hour. These have one purpose, and they give their power and authority to the beast. These will wage war against the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them, because he is the Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are the called and chosen and faithful. And he said to me, the waters which you saw where the harlot sits are peoples and tongues, are peoples and multitudes and nations and tongues. And the 10 horns which you saw and the beast, these will hate the harlot and will make her desolate and naked and will eat her flesh and will burn her up with fire. For God has put it in their hearts to execute his purpose by having a common purpose and by giving their kingdom to the beast until the words of God will be fulfilled. The woman whom you saw is the great city which reigns over the kings of the earth. Now, having identified the scarlet beast, and last time the bull angel identified the scarlet beast as who? It's only been 2 weeks. Who? Thank you. The Antichrist. That scarlet beast is the Antichrist. And remember, the angel pulled from chapters 12 and 13 information that John already had in making that identification. The angel said very basically, this scarlet beast, is the Antichrist. That's who you're looking at. And having identified the seven heads as what? What were the seven heads? Seven kingdoms, seven Gentile kingdoms. Very important to remember, these were seven world Gentile kingdoms. Certainly not all the kingdoms that will ever exist. Certainly not all the kingdoms that existed by the time John was given this revelation. But these are the kingdoms that God uses in his outworking of the covenant purpose, his kingdom covenant purpose with Israel. The first kingdoms, now there's a break in the action. What's the first kingdom? You remember? The ancient kingdom of Egypt. And the last kingdom will be the Antichrist. And there's a gap. Where's the gap in the succession of those kingdoms? It's between what? Between Rome and the Antichrist. Because remember, as Israel is dispersed in 70 AD, as Jerusalem is leveled, and Rome is so angry with the nation of Israel over their continued revolt. And remember, Israel just revolted and revolted and revolted. As one theologian said, they were the most revolting people that God ever placed on earth. And that's true because they used to revolt about it. You know, you go through the Old Testament, every time God places them under punishment, every time God sends someone against Israel, you know, even when they overcome him, Israel immediately goes into revolt. They're just rebels. They really are. But Israel was dispersed in 70 AD. The kingdom program for Israel, that covenant program, really that covenant program wasn't suspended in 70 AD. When was the covenant program with Israel suspended? Thinking about it, logically, when was that covenant program? When did God stop working out that covenant program on a daily basis with Israel? You know, there's really two views. One is when they came out of that captivity. And the second is at the cross, because that was the ultimate rejection of the Messiah. And from that point forward, at least from the cross forward, that covenant purpose, that covenant program has been held in abeyance. That covenant program, these are the days of the Gentiles. Remember, we live in the days of the Gentiles. We live in the great parentheses, that great parentheses between the time really of Abraham and the Antichrist. We live in the parentheses. Abraham begins the covenant program. The covenant program picks up again with the Antichrist. And we kind of live in the parentheses. We're in the days of the Gentiles. These are our salad days. These are the good times to be a Gentile, believe it or not. This is the best time. These are the kingdom times for the Gentiles. So there's that gap between Rome and the Antichrist. We have no idea when that gap will end. It will end. We know when it will end. It will end when the Antichrist executes his covenant with the nation of Israel to begin the tribulation. But we live in that gap between Rome and the Antichrist. All right. So having given those two explanations, the angel now turns to the rest of the picture, which is basically the ten horns and the harlot. You know, it's as if he's describing this image from the ground up, isn't it? He starts with the red body of the beast. He moves up to the head. Then it's the ten horns, and then it's the harlot. You know, as I looked at that description, I was reminded of a song we used to sing back at church camp. And when I went to camp as a kid, it was 1 week of church camp, and believe me, it was church camp. I mean, it was like Sunday school without electricity. But but it was a change of pace. You know, I always marvel when I take my kids to camp when they were growing up, and they'd have such kind of nice camps with nice facilities and, you know, cement ponds to swim in. And, you know, I was thinking when we had a little this mud pond in Iowa, and you'd be looking for the snapping turtles on the water moccasins, you know. It taught you godly alertness. We used to sing a song at camp, and probably some of you know it's The Hole in the Bottom of the Sea. Remember that song? How many of you know that hole in the bottom of the sea? There's a hole in the bottom of the sea. There's a log in the hole in the bottom of the sea. And then there's a bump on the log in the hole in the bottom of the sea. And then there's a frog on the bump on the log in the hole. And it just goes on and on ad nauseum. But when you don't have TV, believe me, as many verses as you can get in, you're just sitting around a fire just singing until you drop off. Kind of reminded me of that old song, though. But you know, only this would be like, you know, there's a harlot with the ten horns on the seven heads on the scarlet beast in the middle of the wilderness. If I had kids young enough to go to church camp, I think I'd try to write that out. So, as it is, I'm going to have to wait until my grandkids are old enough to go to camp. Then I'm going to say, take this and tell them Pops wrote it for you. Yeah, get there. But it starts now, having talked about the scarlet beast and the seven heads, the angel starts to talk about the ten horns. And very simply, what are the ten horns? The angel says, very simply, the ten horns are what? Ten kings. Hey, that's real easy. Ten horns are ten kings. But these are not simply ten kings. You know, in the history of the world has seen tens of thousands of kings come and go, both great and small. When we think of king, we think of kind of on a broad scale, don't we? When we think of that somebody is a king, they have a big kingdom, and they have a big castle, and they have great power and great armies. That's not always been the case. There are some kings, especially in the old world, who are not much more than rulers of towns. They're like the king of Southlake, you know, or the king of Colleyville. Think back in Abraham's time, in the time of the patriarchs. Remember the incident that the Bible records in Genesis where Sodom and Gomorrah are attacked. This is before they're attacked by God. But Sodom and Gomorrah are attacked, and Lot and his family are taken captive. And they're taken away. Abraham goes and rescues everybody. He rescues Lot. He rescues his family. He rescues everybody from Sodom and Gomorrah. Kind of a temporary fix for those people. But he rescues all. When he comes back, he's met by Melchizedek. And who else meets him? The king of Salem. And the king of Sodom. The king of Sodom meets him. And so, you know, that designation of king can be a fairly diminutive designation. But these are ten kings, and these are unique kings. In all the history of mankind, these ten individuals are unique because these are ten kings whose reign was prophesied from about 537 B.C., okay, about 537 B.C. John's receiving this revelation around 90 A.D., so about 627 years have passed, and the reign of these kings has already been prophesied back in Daniel chapter 7. Remember Daniel? I'm talking about the one in the Bible. We all know Daniel, but this is the guy in the Bible. But in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has a vision. I guess we have time to turn back there. You know, the reason we have so much time is because we're babysitting two of our grandkids. I can't pick them up till noon anyway. You know what that means? You're here with me. Yeah. I got all the time in the world. I got till noon today. Does that seem unfair to anybody else that you can't just pick up your kid whenever you show up? Oh, that's not it. I think they should give you the kid. But in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel has a vision. Daniel has, and that's important because remember in the book of Daniel, there are a number of visions. About half of them are Daniel's and about half of them are Nebuchadnezzar's. But this is one of Daniel's, where Daniel is not describing or interpreting for someone else. This is a vision Daniel actually has. It's the vision of the four beasts, and it's followed on the heels with the vision of the Ancient of Days. Really, those two visions are connected. In your Bible, it may have them separated, but it's separated because the four beasts are presented, and then the Ancient of Days comes. So a lot of the people who kind of make up the chapters and divide them under headings think, well, that kind of clarifies it. But it's the vision of the four beasts and the Ancient of Days. Now, in that vision, Daniel sees four beasts. And those four beasts represent four kingdoms of the world. Each of those kingdoms is slightly different than the other, but the fourth kingdom is unique. The fourth kingdom, which is the Antichrist, is larger than the other three. It's more vicious than the other three. It's more destructive than the other three. Those four kingdoms, rather. In fact, the angel describes that kingdom as he describes it. It says that when the angel describes that kingdom later on, the angel, in explaining who the fourth image was, the angel says that the fourth image is the one who would devour the whole earth. It has that global impact. And the ten horns, or kings, will come up as part of that ultimate kingdom. Now, here in Revelation 17, the bowl angel, we're going to go back to Revelation 17, but that bowl angel, some 625 years later, tells Daniel a couple things, or tells John, rather, a couple things about these angels. First of all, have these angels come, I mean, have these rulers, rather, these kings come to being yet? Are these kings on the scene? No, they haven't arrived yet. They're not present. How do we know that? What does the angel first of all say about them? Yeah, they haven't received their kingdoms yet. Now, this is about 90 A.D. Who does that disqualify? When you read commentaries on Revelation and they start talking about who these people must be, who does that disqualify? Who? Yeah, everybody at least prior to that point. Everybody from Genesis 1:1 to Revelation 17. So anytime you're reading a commentary, one of the common things to do is to try to, let's play name that king. And they want to hook a Roman emperor up or an Egyptian pharaoh up. And that has to be one of the ten. Well, we know that as of the moment of the vision and the moment of the explanation in Revelation 17, those ten kings weren't on the scene yet. They hadn't received their power. However, what will they do, according to John? They're not present, but what will happen? They will reign. Now, the angel is speaking for who? When the angel is giving this explanation, who's he speaking for? God. So the angel this is a guarantee by God that while these ten kings have not arrived yet and have not received a kingdom yet, they will be there. They will come. They will reign. They'll receive a kingdom. And who will they reign with? The Antichrist. They'll reign with the beast. So their reigns will partially coincide with whatever we know about the reign of the Antichrist. They will partially coincide. His will begin first. Theirs will follow. Now, you notice that word with can have a lot of means. And that can simply mean coexist. If you said you went to, you were back in high school with so-and-so. Well, that just can mean, we were in class at the same time, or we attended school at the same time. That with is kind of a broad word, at least the way we use it. But the way with that word is used in this context, it doesn't simply mean that they coexist. It means that their rule is in union with and agreement with. That is the word that's used for union and agreement. So when the angel tells John that these ten will reign with the Antichrist, he's not simply talking about coexistence. He's talking about these are ten men, and the pronoun used is masculine. These ten men will rule in union with and agreement with the Antichrist. How long will they rule? An hour. Do you think they mean more than an hour? What does that equal? Yeah, 60 minutes. Don't do the math. Don't do the math. I've read a couple commentaries where they try to determine how long the kings will reign simply based on that hour. And they say, well, we know that the Antichrist is going to reign for how long? He reigns in which week? The 70th week. So how long does he reign? 1 week. And 1 week equals 7 years. All right. So we know how much the Antichrist rules. And so if we take a week, there's 24 hours in a day, 168 hours in a week. And he reigns for one. So he reigns for one 168. So if we can just figure out how many days are in 7 years, and that's pretty easy to do, and we take one 168th of that, that's how long the kings will rule, which is probably about 5 or 6 days. That's not what it means. They reign for more than 5 or 6 days. An hour is simply used in Scripture to denote a relatively short period of time. There is no prophetic line for an hour. Daniel talks about those 70 weeks. And John and the angels explain what weeks equal. And back in Daniel, we find out through the major and minor prophets that weeks are years and how we calculate that. But any time you see an hour listed in the Bible, it's simply meant to denote a relatively short period of time. So we know that their reign is during the second half of this, of the Antichrist rule, because that's when he occupies a position that enables him to establish them. But it's for a short time. This really makes sense. And remember, the Antichrist is going to rule for that whole 7 years, start to finish. But at the midpoint, we've got that whole abomination of desolation. And remember, in this first half, what is the Antichrist? What's his position? Really, on a world scheme, in a worldwide stage, what is he doing? What's his position? Rule what? On the first half. What does he rule in the first half? Really, he rules Israel. That's all he rules. That first half, that's all he does. And the rest of the world is just up for grabs. The rest of the world's enveloped in all the plagues and the world war. But that's all the Antichrist is involved in, is that first half is ruling Israel. Midpoint, we have that abomination of desolation. And you remember the description that the angel gave of the Antichrist earlier in chapter 17. He said, this is the one who was and is not and is about to come out of the abyss and go into perdition or destruction. There's that whole sense in which from the second half on, even though the Antichrist doesn't know it, he's just quickly heading to his destruction. Now, those 10 kings pop up somewhere here, probably somewhere along the front end of this, as the Antichrist consolidates his rule and assigns who's going to rule what. They hitch their star to the Antichrist. It's almost like getting on a toboggan to hell. You know, that's not a verse. But I think it would be a very memorable verse. Thou shalt not get on the toboggan to hell. But these 10 kings, they think they're hitching, they'll think they're hitching their wagon to a star, won't they? Because they're going to get on, they're going to rule a tenth of the world, they're going to be associated with this world ruler. These 10 kings, I'm telling you, they think the sky's the limit. When in truth and in fact, they are on the downhill side with this Antichrist. They're going down with him. So these 10 men will reign in a union with the Antichrist. They'll rule in agreement with him, and they will rule for a shorter period of time than him. Really, this last half of the tribulation, once he's consolidated his power. So their rule is shorter. Their end is sure. Now, they're not identified, and it's pointless to try to identify them. They very well could be, you know, you just pick anybody, but they could well be his confidants. They could be men who were his allies during the first half of the tribulation, who kind of banded with him. It doesn't really matter who they are. What matters is who they are once the Antichrist empowers them. They are the men who will rule the earth. And that is amazing to think that they will rule the earth. 11 men will rule the earth. You know, you see today, sometimes you'll read in Newsweek or Time, who are the most influential political leaders. And every year, you know what happens? It changes. It seems to change. Now, in our country, it doesn't change except maybe once every 4 years. And that's not a prayer request. That's an observation. But it changes about once every 4 years. But in some parts of the world, that change is remarkable. I mean, you look at the Arab nations. You look at the nations right now that are undergoing turmoil there in northern Africa and in the Middle East, and you see remarkable changes in leadership in just a matter of months or even weeks. But during this time, there will be 11 men who rule the world. The Antichrist will basically rule Israel and north. He'll go north into the area that we think of as the old Babylonian Empire, north of Palestine. And the rest of the world, which is a relatively small amount of land. In fact, the Antichrist will probably rule, in terms of square miles, probably have the smallest kingdom in the world. In all probability, based on the descriptions, the Antichrist will probably have the smallest. It'll be most crucial, but it'll be the smallest. And the rest of the world will be divided up among 10 men. They will have, look at what the angel says, the 10 horns, say they haven't received, they have one purpose. In verse 13, they have one purpose, one mind, total unity, a total shared focus. And their reign will have two distinguishing characteristics. The Bible doesn't tell us anything about who they are or where they'll reign or where their capitals will be, but the Bible tells us two things that summarize their reign. First of all, what's the first thing they're going to do in verse 13 that summarizes their reign? What are they going to do? Give their power to who? To the beast. Now, that's kind of interesting. Because before you can give something, what do you have to do? You have to have it. These men will be in positions of power. That's why I said these will probably be rulers who have ruled different areas or in different areas of the world before the Antichrist takes power in the second half of the tribulation. So these will not just be people, you know, that he calls up on the phone and says, you know, I'm going through the phone book. How'd you like to be a king? No, these are guys who have a proven track record, either militarily and probably militarily. Because think about how the world will be in chaos during that first half of the tribulation. The only people who are going to be able to stay in power and maintain any sort of power are going to be the military leaders, aren't they? I mean, you know, the mild-mannered politician isn't going to live long. It's going to be the generals that run the world. So these are men who have some power, and they take that power and they give it to the beast. They give their unanimous and complete support to the beast. They give their power, not some of their power, not a portion of their power. They give whatever they have to the beast. They support him completely. And during the second half of the tribulation, what are some of the things that the Antichrist, that the beast is going to be doing that God might not approve of? Just a few of the things. Yeah, how about that? Blaspheming God. God might not approve of that. And what do these guys do? They give their power to the beast. What else does he do? What are some of the other things he does? That's pretty much it, I know. But how about a little thing called genocide? He has a program of genocide against who? Against the Jews and against Christians. Against believers. Yeah, he's blaspheming God. He has genocide. He's claiming to be God and demanding the worship due God. He is establishing this false religious system. How does he handle the two witnesses? Kills them. Those are God's representatives. That's just the tip of the iceberg as to what the Antichrist is doing during the second half of the tribulation. And these 10 kings give them their full support. Whatever power they have, they give to that man. This is why they will be judged as he is judged. No one will ever be able, and these 10 kings especially, will never be able to stand before God and say, hey, look, I know what was going on was wrong, but we were just taking orders. That whole taking orders thing doesn't fly with God. God is very big, and the Bible teaches this time and again, and it plays out for you and me and for everyone else, individual responsibility. God is very big on individual responsibility. There is no group liability. There is individual responsibility. These men, the first defining characteristic of their rule is that they give their power to the king. They will, or to the Antichrist. They will endorse and enforce his kingdom program. They simply will not passively sit by and say that's good, thereby endorsing it. They'll enforce it. They are his henchmen on a worldwide basis. They're his henchmen in the genocide of the nation of Israel, in the genocide of the believers. They're his henchmen. They enforce it. They enforce his demand that he be worshipped, that everyone bow down to the image of the beast. They enforce it. They endorse and rejoice in the murder of the witnesses. This is what they do. This is why they will be judged as the Antichrist is judged. What's the second thing they do, though? What's the second defining characteristic there in verse 14? Wage war with who? Wage war with the Lamb. Now, they wage war with the Lamb in two respects. Ultimately, when do they wage war with the Lamb? At the what? No. Armageddon, yeah, further on down. At Armageddon, at the last battle of Armageddon, and that's where we left them in chapter 16. When chapter 16 closed, they were just waiting to catch it. But they will wage war with the Lamb as all 10 unite. And in fact, it's a reunion tour because they reunite with the Antichrist at that moment. And they wage war against the Lamb who is coming. That is the ultimate point where they wage war. But how also are they going to wage war during this last 3.5 years with the Lamb? Against the believers. That genocide, it's not just Armageddon. It's genocide. They are attacking the people of God. They are attacking the children of God. And let me tell you something. When you attack God's people, you attack God. You know, Tom made that point in a general reference this morning about what's wrong with murder. I mean, this isn't the only thing that's wrong with murder. But ultimately, of course, it's a crime against God because man is created in the image of God. And so to murder a man or a woman, we'll put that in, to murder a human being is actually an affront to God. It's an attack on God. Let me tell you, when you attack the people of God, you ultimately attack God. And while that punishment, the retribution, might not be just immediately forthcoming, I mean, face it, sometimes in the Old Testament, you saw immediate punishment. You know, the nations would come up against Israel, and God would just go out and destroy them. Oh, that would just be wonderful. God would just go out and destroy them. But you know something in the Old Testament? I mean, in the New Testament, rather. We get to the New Testament, and the servants of God are routinely brutalized and martyred. And where's the judgment? Well, the judgment is ultimate, isn't it? The judgment is eternal. When you attack the children of God, the people of God, you attack God. You know, that promise that God made to Abraham is, you know, those who bless you, I will bless. Those who curse you, I will curse. It is just as valid today as it was when God spoke it. That's why this nation has been blessed partially because of our support of the nation of Israel. And I'll tell you something. Our national interest is tied to our treatment of Israel. And anybody who says different knows nothing about the Bible. Our national interest is intimately and inextricably tied to our continued support of Israel. And that is why when you read in the paper about changes in policy, when politicians get up and talk about changes in policy, of how we're going to treat Israel and how we're going to support her enemies, let me tell you something, we're cutting our own throat. And God's given us the knife. Just something to keep in mind if you're ever talking to a politician. So ultimately, they will do war with the Lamb at Armageddon. Temporally, as the second half of the tribulation goes on, they will do war with the Lamb by attacking his people. But of course, as verse 14 says, when you attack the Lamb, what happens? When you do war with the Lamb, what's always the end result? Yeah, defeat. It's defeat. What does the Lamb do? He does what? He overcomes them. That's another one of those vague words, isn't it? You can overcome somebody. I mean, you know, you go watch a sporting event. Somebody overcomes them. You go watch a football game. One team overcomes the other. Or a baseball game. One team overcomes. You know, one of the differences is everybody lives. Everybody lives through those things. Back in chapter 13 of Revelation, God gave the Antichrist, the beast, some power over the saints. What was the Antichrist given the authority to do? To make war with the saints and to overcome them. And what did that word mean back in Revelation 13? What did it mean to overcome the saints? To martyr them, to kill them. That's what it meant. It didn't simply mean to best them, to lock them up someplace. He was given power to overcome them, as in to kill them. Guess what? Four chapters later, overcome means the same thing. The Lamb doesn't simply best them. He simply doesn't defeat them. The Lamb will eradicate them. He will eliminate them. It's the same word. And why will he? There's a simple explanation. He is, first of all, he's who? The Lord of Lords. The Lord of Lords. That's who the Lamb is. And remember, and he's also who? King of Kings. Now, in the Old Testament, who was the Lord of Lords and the King of Kings? Yahweh. Yahweh God. The God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God is one God. It was that designation for God, thought of as God the Father. Lord of Lords, first appeared in Daniel, back in Daniel chapter 10. That's the first time God was called Lord of Lords. But it means, both of them mean basically the same thing. Sovereign of sovereigns. The unparalleled one. You know, in modern language, the boss's boss. But remember, one of the points of the book of Revelation is that Jesus Christ is who? He is God. And he is not a lesser God. He is not another God. He is God. The Lamb is God. And this is a definitive statement by the angel. Remember, this is the bowl angel speaking, and the bowl angel speaks for who? God, the Father, who is, through the book of Revelation, revealing the truth about His Son. And through the bowl angel, God says, this is, the Lamb is, the Lord of lords and the King of kings. A definitive statement. A definitive statement of absolute deity. Anybody who ever tries to argue that Jesus Christ is something lesser than the Father has never read this, or at least has never understood it. This is God the Father speaking and saying, this is who my Son is. He is me. He and I are one. He wasn't just using a metaphor when he said, I and the Father am one. He is me, King of kings and Lord of lords, and as such, he will always triumph. And he won't be alone in his triumph. Who will he come with? Who will he come with? The chosen. How are they defined? Who does he come with? He uses really three words. The chosen. Faithful. The what? Faithful. The faithful. The called. Are these three different groups? No. They're all one group. These are the armies of heaven. We don't have time, but back in Jude 14. I always loved Jude as a kid because if our teachers said, our Sunday school teacher said, I want everybody to read a book of the Bible this week. Philemon and Jude were the most widely read books growing up. Jude, a little scary, but they're nice and short. Anytime you can refer to a book by just Jude 14 and you're not talking about a chapter. But in Jude 14, one of those little books, and you know, some one of these days we're going to look at Jude. We're going to look at Jude. But in Jude 14, it says that he comes, the Messiah comes, with the armies of heaven. Now, before this moment, when the armies of heaven had massed, who comprised the armies of heaven? When Satan and his demons attacked the gates of heaven, what armies met him? The angels. All the angels led by Michael? Yeah, the archangel Michael. They all met him at the gates and bounced them back to earth. So up to this point, when the armies of heaven have been referenced, the armies of heaven have always been referenced in angelic terms. Remember when Satan had Jesus Christ on the pinnacle of the temple and he said, you know, jump. You know, the angels are swooped down. It's this picture that there's always an army ready to swoop down and protect. Even today, you know, people talk about guardian angels. And, you know, it's like there's some regiment of guardian angels. And, you know, I'm not going to go into that. I've heard pros and cons. But we always think of these angels as being the members of heaven. Well, in this army, that's not who it is. Are the angels chosen? No, they're not chosen. Angels aren't chosen. Are they faithful? Well, you got to give them that. You got to give them that. No, I'm not going to go there. Is it an act of volition with the angels? Yeah, see? That's one of the big differences. The angels did, at one point, possess the ability to make that call, though, didn't they? And when did they make that call? When Satan fell originally, at that initial fall of Satan, up to that point, the angels obviously had the ability within their makeup to make that kind of call. They made it. And apparently that's one of those calls that you make, and that was it. That's it. There's no going back left or right. So they had, at a point, they were faithful. And of course, they're called. And who does that describe? Us. Yeah, that's us. We will comprise the armies of heaven who view the Lamb overcoming the armies of the world. We will be there. We'll look at that when we get there in 2 weeks in chapter 19. We're just going to buzz right through 18. Yeah, that's going to happen. When we get to chapter 19 and we're looking at that battle, let me tell you something. We're going to be there. You and I are going to be there. We're going to be with Christ. We're going to see Him overcome. And you know something, not to be a spoiler, but we're going to be spectators, not warriors. So don't bother to gird up your loins, as they say in the Old Testament. Always a phrase I love. Gird up your loins. So don't gird up your loins. We're just there for the show. But we will see, we will witness that overcoming as parts of the armies of heaven. All right, that's the ten horns. They're ten kings. They're the ten kings whose reign was prophesied by Daniel back in 537 A.D. They're the ten kings, or B.C. rather. They're the ten kings that still haven't come on the scene as of Revelation 17. They're the ten kings who are not on the scene today. Now, somebody might say, well, they could be. They could be. I mean, what if the tribulation started next week? Maybe some of those guys are ruling. Yeah, it could be. Could be. But identifiably, they're not on the scene. They're the ten kings who will rule with the Antichrist during a portion of the last half of the Great Tribulation. That's their rise, that's their reign, and that's their ultimate demise. But that does not finish the picture. Having taken care of the beast, the heads and the horns, the angel's attention is now quickly drawn to the harlot. Before he can explain the rest, there has to be the harlot. And he begins at the beginning. He begins with a reference back to chapter 17, verse 1, where the harlot was described as the one who sits beside the many waters. That is not a reference to Minnesota. That's the land of 10,000 lakes. Is anybody here from Minnesota? Got one from Minnesota. Even as a kid, I didn't believe that anybody had counted 10,000 lakes. There's a lot of lakes up there. I'm not buying 10,000. Of course, if it was Texas, I mean, how would you do that? The logistics. In Texas, it's easy. If that was our slogan, it'd be like, land of eight lakes and a bunch of tanks. Eight lakes we can count. You know? Eight man-made lakes. Okay. That I can believe. This references back, though. And how does it describe the many waters? How does the angel describe the many waters in 15? They're what? People. Peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. Have we seen that description given before in the book of Revelation? Yeah. Back in chapter 13, it described what? Back in chapter 13, that same description described the rule of the Antichrist, the extent of the rule of the Antichrist. The only difference is, back in chapter 13, instead of, here it says multitudes, there it said tribes, but it's the same difference. It doesn't necessarily, you know, identify nationalities, obviously. But what is it referencing? What is it demonstrating? When it says the tribes, the multitudes, the nations, the tongues, what's God really getting at? He's describing what? The scope. Yeah. It's the world. It's the scope. It's a global rule. This harlot, whatever she is, will have a global impact on everyone. On everyone except the handful of Israel that are being preserved, and those few miserable believers who are still living in a cave. Apart from that, the harlot will have a global impact. Her rule in the spiritual realm will equal the rule of the Antichrist in the physical realm. That's really the best way to put it. Think of the Antichrist kingdom as really consisting of two parts, a physical part and a spiritual part. The physical part is that geographical, political, economic part that he and his ten kings rule over. The spiritual part is the false religion, that false system of religion that the harlot rules over. That's what she rules. You know, and in some ways, as I was thinking about it this week, isn't the impact of the harlot more deadly than the impact of the economics and the politics and the military? Because what are we damned for? What is man, what is an individual condemned for? Are we condemned for our economics or our politics? Yeah, for our sin, for rejection of God, for the spiritual issues. That's what condemns an individual to an eternity apart from God. Not how you voted in the last election, not how you budget your money, but what's your spiritual condition before God? And that's the area over which the harlot will exercise her authority. But that authority will be short-lived. You remember, when does the Antichrist decide he's going to set up this false system? It's not until when? Right here, at the halfway mark. It's not that the Antichrist has set up a false religious system that goes through 7 years. This false religious system, you know, we just compress down into this last half of the tribulation, the Great Tribulation. So we're talking about max 3.5 years, and really not even quite 3.5, because, you know, there's a startup, isn't there? It's like any new business, you got to have a startup. Well, there's going to be a startup here. But that false religious system is just really here. So the harlot, whatever here it is, exists during that last half. And her end comes, as the angel says, her end comes, if this is Armageddon, her end comes sometime before Armageddon, because the harlot has destroyed before then. In fact, the harlot is destroyed before the sixth bowl. How do we know that? The destruction of the harlot is occasioned by an attack of the ten kings coupled with the Antichrist. By the sixth bowl, what's happened after the sixth bowl? That alliance is gone. The ten kings are no longer in alliance with the Antichrist. So if all 11 are involved in the attack, we know that it has to come at some point, shortly before the last bowl, or before the seventh bowl, and probably between the fifth or the sixth bowl. In the end, Satan's kingdom will turn against itself. It will divide, signifying that the end truly is at hand. Now, does it make any sense that a kingdom will turn against itself, that will implode? It doesn't make sense, does it? I mean, why would you turn against yourself? Why would you implode? And yet we see that. We see that if you're a student of history, we've seen that in many kingdoms. Probably the last greatest kingdom that we saw that in was the Sixth Empire, wasn't it? Rome. Rome rotted from the inside out. It imploded. Satan's kingdom will implode. Back in Mark, and we're not going to go there because we don't have time, but back in Mark, and Jesus wasn't talking about end times, but he stated a truth. It came back to me as I read this. It's his famous house divided statement. Jesus is talking to the scribes and about the unpardonable sin. Jesus said, how can Satan cast out Satan? Remember the scribes and Pharisees said he casts out devils in the name by using the power of Beelzebub. And Jesus says, how can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. If a house is divided against itself, that house will not be able to stand. If Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand. He is finished. You know, he wasn't speaking eschatologically, but doesn't that apply? We see that truth, that eternal truth carried out here. Sin is self-destructive. And by the way, about 1,800 years later, Abraham Lincoln said pretty much the same thing, didn't he? House divided against itself. Now, I was born and raised in Illinois, and if Jesus said it, and Abraham Lincoln said it, hey, we're not questioning it. In fact, if either one of them said it, no. But that's the practical outworking of that godly truth. There is no explanation for why the Antichrist, there is no logical, human logical explanation for why the Antichrist and the Ten Kings would unite to destroy this false religious system. It doesn't appear to make sense. But you know something? That is the path of sin. Sin is so destructive that it eventually will turn on itself. You know, there is no honor among thieves. Sin is so destructive that ultimately, left unchecked by God, it turns on itself. The reason we don't see that more often in our world today, and we see it time and again, but the reason we don't see it more often in the world today is common grace. God limits how far he allows sin to run its course in this world today. God simply takes his hand off in the tribulation, and we see sin run its logical course. And it's the course of sin to be self-destructive. It destroys everything else around it, but it destroys itself. Now, that begs the question, what does it destroy? If these ten kings and the Antichrist unite to destroy the harlot, what is it destroying? What is the harlot? That's the $64,000 question. What is the harlot? Well, keep in mind that in Revelation, the harlot is really referenced as two things. On a grand scale, the harlot is what? The false religion. It's a false system. It is a false religious system. And its organization, and its leadership, and its teachings, that's what the harlot is. That is the harlot on a global scale. But the harlot is also a central locale of that system. That system will have a central locale, a central location, just as the Mormons have Salt Lake City. Yeah. Is the capital of this country going to be moved to Salt Lake City in a year and a half? I don't know. And the Catholics have Vatican City? Well, I guess it won't, because, I mean, if Kennedy didn't move the capital to Vatican City, I don't imagine Mitt Romney would get away with moving us to Salt Lake City. But as many false religions do, this one will have a system. There is a lot of disagreement about what city is referenced here. Because that is what's the judgment here in chapter 17 and that we'll see in 18 and part of 19 requires the destruction of something concrete, not just an ideal. I mean, you can destroy an ideal, you can destroy a theology, but the type of destruction requires the destruction of a physical plant, of a physical location. And certainly people have said it's Jerusalem. Other commentators have said it's Rome. Others have said it's Richland Hills or Euless. You know, I'm going to rule out Jerusalem and Rome. But I've been to Richland Hills and Euless. It could be. Now, probably the best argument, and again, our time doesn't permit us to go into all these, is that this is Babylon. That this is a revived Babylon. A central locale, a revived Babylon. Time doesn't permit us. But the Old Testament, major and minor prophets both say that when Messiah comes, Babylon will be destroyed, and Babylon will be destroyed completely and will be eternally desolate. That Babylon will never be inhabited again, that city. Now, we all think of Babylon as being destroyed when? Who destroyed them? The Medes and the Persians. The Medes and the Persians. We all know, writing on the wall. Remember? Yeah. And the city was laid to waste. But you know something? The city wasn't just destroyed and left desolate. Babylon as a city has never been uninhabited. Babylon is still in existence today on the banks of the Euphrates. Babylon is, I won't say thriving, but Babylon is inhabited by probably 15 to 20,000 people. And during the first half of the tribulation, the Antichrist will begin a move to move power to Babylon, to rebuild that city, to revive that city as ultimately what he intends to be his capital city. Now, in the first half of the tribulation, where is he going to be hanging out? Jerusalem. Why is it safe for him to hang out in Jerusalem in the first half of the tribulation? Yeah, it's where his power is. He signed the covenant. Israel loves him. He's their guy. He's their guy. He's their savior. But what happens in the second half of the tribulation? At that halfway point, he does what? Abomination, desolation, goes into the temple, sets himself up as God. From that point forward, from the abomination of desolation to the end of the tribulation, what's the Antichrist's relationship with the nation of Israel? Adversarial. Worse than adversarial. Israel will be in a state of civil war. Only civil war, it's not that they will be fighting each other, but they'll be fighting the government that is over them. Israel will be a nation in revolt, active revolt, constant revolt against the Antichrist for the last half of the tribulation. He will be moving his authority, his power, up to Babylon, because quite frankly, Israel won't be safe. Jerusalem will not be a safe haven for him anymore. And during that second half of the tribulation, Babylon will become the seat of his power. It will become the seat of that false religious system. He'll run everything through Babylon. That's where the wealth is going to go. That's where everything will be centralized, primarily from an economic and religious standpoint. Oh, he'll still maintain his presence down in Jerusalem. But the best argument can be made for that Babylon. Now, the ten kings and the Antichrist will attack Babylon and that system. And they'll do three things to it, real quickly. Three things. What are they going to do to it? According to the angel, what are they going to do to it? They'll make her first what? Desolate in my Bible. If you have a different version, that's okay, but my Bible says desolate. Desolate. That refers to a financial plundering. That refers to they will enter Babylon, they will enter the harlot, and they will take everything of value. And I suggest that's not just on a local scale of Babylon, but worldwide. Whatever that system has will be stripped away from it in terms of value by the kings. Is that the only time we've ever seen that in the history of man? Nah. You remember in ancient days in the old world, let's go back to the Old Testament, when Jerusalem was invaded. Where are the two places that invading armies would go once they had subdued Jerusalem? They go to the temple and the palace. The temple and the palace. Why would they go to the temple and the palace first? That's where the money is. Like Dillinger said, why do you rob banks? Because that's where they keep the money. Well, you know something? When they go into a city and they go to plunder it, they go to the palace and the temple. But you know something? That was true when the children of Israel were taking over the promised land, and they would go. Remember what they'd do? They'd plunder, wouldn't they? With the exception of that Ai business, which was not a good deal. But after Ai, they were free to plunder every city that they took over. And that's what will happen. The kings will plunder. They will strip the false religious system of all the wealth that it has accumulated during the short term of its existence. The second thing they'll do is what? They'll make her desolate. Naked. They'll humiliate her. This system will be rife with corruption from top to bottom. I can't figure that out. It's founded by a false prophet, and its God is the Antichrist, and it's corrupt? That just doesn't make sense. Yeah, what else do you want? Of course it's corrupt from top to bottom. And the corruption of that will be exposed. Now, what do you think is going to be true about the internal corruption? Do you think the world as a whole is going to be on the inside of that internal corruption? Nah. In false religions today, when corruption is exposed time and time again, what's always the first, you know, they always, I feel sorry for these people, but they always interview people coming out of the conference headquarters or the churches that follow these false religions, and they always stick a microphone in them, right up in front of them. They say, hey, what do you think? Your pastor just been, you know, he's a homosexual. What do you think about that? Well, I didn't know. You know, hey, your founder's been looting the bank accounts, and he's walked away $20 million. I know. You know, nobody knows. Nobody. Let me tell you something. While everyone will be participating in this false religious system, the leadership will be hiding behind a false cloak of piety and worship, and the membership will think they're worshiping a god, and they will be exposed. The leadership will be naked. They will be stripped away of that false piety, and the whole world will see their nakedness. They'll scorn them. They'll ridicule them. And the last thing they're going to do is devour them and burn them up with fire. Total destruction. They're going to make them desolate. They're going to humiliate them. It's total destruction. You can eat something and pieces are still left over. But when you devour something, what happens? There's nothing. You remember back in 1 Kings chapter 21, we don't have time to go there, but Jezebel, the girl who everybody names their daughters after, Jezebel gets pushed out of the window. You remember her colorful death. She gets pushed out of the window by two eunuchs. We don't even need a lesson for that. But she's, and when her body hits the pavement, what happens? No, not yet. What happens to her body before the dogs get to it? Yeah, the chariots run over it. I mean, it's almost like a Bugs Bunny cartoon, except it's so gruesome. You know, a eunuch pushes her out of the window, chariots run over, boom, the horses stomp her. And then later, though, the new king says, you know something, she was the daughter of a queen, and she was a queen, go bury the body. And when his men go out to bury the body, what do they find? They find a hand. The dogs, it says, the dogs had devoured her. There was nothing left. This system, this place, this Babylon is going to be devoured, and she's going to be burned up with fire. You can burn something, but if you don't burn it completely, there's still things left in the ashes. When you burn something up, what's left? Nothing. In Leviticus 21 and 22, the law sets out that the punishment for fornication, under the law, is to be burned up with fire. And as the angel, three chapters ago, has said, the harlot will commit fornication with the kings of the earth, and she receives her just punishment. She is made desolate. She's humiliated. She is destroyed. Now, no immediate cause is given, but as the angel says in verse 17, who's behind all this? God. Yeah. You don't need to know who the immediate cause is. The ultimate cause is God. And he's put it in the hearts of these men to join with the Antichrist. You notice he's never put it in the hearts of these men to make war with the Lamb. He's never put it in the hearts of these men to make war with the believers. But he put it in the hearts of these men to surrender their power to the Antichrist. And he just lets sin run its course. And the angel closes with that explanation. That's the beast. Those are the heads. Those are the horns. That's the harlot. The economics, or the religious system and the capital lie in ruins. The economic empire is next. And that's what we go into in 2 weeks. So what do we take away from this very quickly? First of all, I think we're reminded of the destructive power of sin. Just as the beast will devour the whole earth, and the ten kings and the Antichrist will devour Babylon and that religious system. You know something? That's what sin does. Sin devours. Sin doesn't nibble. Sin does not eat until it is satisfied. Sin devours whatever it gets into. Sin devours lives. It devours relationships. It can devour our relationship with God, even as a believer. Sin is never satisfied. Sin never gets full and stops. Sin will eat and eat until it's destroyed in our lives. I'll tell you something. We need to address sin seriously in our lives. There's no such thing as a small sin. It will eat and eat and eat until it devours you. Second of all, we can take comfort in the certainty of God's word. In 537 B.C., Daniel proclaimed on behalf of God that these ten kings would come along, and they will come along. And as Christians, we can take great comfort in the certainty of God's word because we can look at the promises. But I'll tell you something, when we look at those promises, we have to look at the warnings too. As Christians, there are more warnings to us than there are promises. You ever think about that? You go through the Bible, and there are more warnings for sin, for the continued countenance of sin in our lives, than there are promises for blessings. And the reason is the blessings will take care of themselves. We're responsible. We're responsible for addressing sin. We cannot pile up blessing, but I'll tell you something, we can address sin, and we need to address sin. And finally, we can rest in the sovereignty of God, regardless of circumstances, our God is in control. Just as he puts it in the hearts of these men to throw their power in with the beast, God directs the hearts of men. He directs your life and mine. This week, take God at his word. Don't countenance any sin. Don't allow any sin to find a place in your life. It will eat until it's devoured. Find your confidence in the sovereignty of God. Let's close in prayer. Lord God, so often we confess that we do not address sin quickly enough or seriously enough in our lives. May we never forget that sin is a beast that eats and eats and is never filled. Lord, through the Holy Spirit, reveal any sin in our lives this week. And Lord, help us to root that out in your strength and your power. Let it not devour any portion of our lives. Lord, we thank you for the certainty of your word. But Lord, may we take the warnings of your word just as certainly as we take your blessings. Lord, may we be reminded that even though we are saved from destruction and we are saved from ultimate punishment, there is still a price to be paid for disobedience. Lord, you are a sovereign God. We look forward to the time when we kneel before you in person, even as we kneel before you in absentia. We pray this in your name. Amen.